you know the difference between two Latin terms? The first one of them is de facto, and the other one is de jure. Well, if you ever went to law school, you probably learned that de jure means as a matter of law. De facto simply means something outside of the law. And that distinction is going to be extremely important today because we're going to be speaking with Richard Rothstein. He's written a new book. It's called The Color of Law. And as you might guess, it has to do with color, with race, and with discrimination. It seems that there's a mythology in this country that much of the racial discrimination that occurs, especially with regard to things like housing, is simply de facto. It simply happens out in society. It has nothing to do with the law. But as Richard Rothstein insists, it does have to do with the law, and that has constitutional consequences. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week, it's The Color of Law.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee. YWC is underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
Take a good look at yourself. What color are you? Take a look at your neighbors. Are they the same color? Yeah, probably so. It's pretty much an open secret that we tend to segregate ourselves in this nation by race, at least when it comes to where we live. Is this something that's just a matter of individual decisions, millions of individual decisions made by millions of individual people, black, white, brown, all different colors? Or did the government play a role in what is really a remarkably segregated housing pattern that exists in this country? Well, there's a myth out there that it's all just a matter of individual decisions, and therefore, to a great extent, beyond legal or constitutional remedy. Richard Rothstein thinks that this is something that people need to know more about. He has written a book called The Color of Law, in which he points out that this was not just a matter of de facto discrimination, but of de jure discrimination. That is, the government has played a big role in creating our segregated society. And he'd like our government to do something about it.
My name is Richard Rothstein. I'm a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute and a fellow at the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. I do research on race and education issues primarily and write about them, several books and many articles.
Well, that sounds very substantial. How long have you been doing that, Richard?
About 30 years.
Well, okay, I guess you know what you're doing by now. And I understand that among the books you've written is a new one all about segregation. Could you tell us about that, please?
Yes, the book is called The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. And it's an accounting of how the federal, state, and local governments, through racially explicit policies, created segregated areas in every metropolitan community in this country. We have a national myth. It's been perpetrated by the Supreme Court, but adopted by liberals and conservatives alike, that we have something in this country called de facto segregation, segregation that happened without public policy, that happened because of personal prejudices or private choices of where to live, or the actions of private actors like real estate agents or banks, or income differences that prevented African Americans from moving to middle class neighborhoods. That notion of de facto segregation is a myth. It has great consequences because if the segregation of metropolitan areas was not created by government policy, then under the Supreme Court's current doctrines, there's no remedy for it. If it was created by millions of individual actions and private choices, it can only be undone by millions of individual actions and private choices.
Right. Constitutionally speaking, we would reference the doctrine of state action. The government has to act before someone can hold up his hand and assert a constitutional right, and in this case, perhaps equal protection. And what you're saying is that there's a myth that the government didn't actually create this, that the government really did have a hand in this, and therefore perhaps there should be a constitutional remedy.
Well, more than that, if we have what is commonly called de jure segregation, where the government had more than a hand in it, but actually controlled, directed, structured residential segregation, not only are we permitted to remedy it, but we're obligated to remedy it. If the Constitution is violated, we're obligated to remedy that violation. What I say in the book is letting bygones be bygones is not a constitutional policy. And so the fact that we believe that the government did not have a role or did not have a major role in the segregation of the metropolitan areas hobbles our ability to remedy it. And so it's necessary, it's important to learn this history, to refresh our memories about this history, because unless we do understand it, our ability to think of how to undo it is very limited.
Understood. And you're not just talking about the obvious, the Jim Crow policies in the South. I mean, everybody recognizes that those were governmental policies that at least in theory were overturned in the Brown versus Board of Education decisions. But you're not saying that that's the only de jure discrimination that existed, right?
Well, even in the South, we have the myth that residential segregation was not de jure. Jim Crow laws were not implemented in the South to cover residential neighborhoods. They were implemented to cover, bus riding and restaurants and water fountains and schools. But the de jure segregation that I'm talking about took place across the country, not through laws, not through Jim Crow laws, but through very explicit government policies written down. These were not the unintended consequences of benign actions, but explicit policies designed to create residential segregation, and it was not restricted to the South. In fact, it was primarily directed at the North, the Midwest, and the West.
Oh, wow. I'm sure there are a lot of people who are going to be very surprised to hear that. Well, let's take it chronologically. I mean, when did all of this start?
Well, it started slowly after World War I. But it really ramped up. I can come back later to the World War I period. Mm-hmm. But the key issue, the key time that it really ramped up was during the New Deal, when federal money was actually put into the process of residential segregation. One of the first programs of the New Deal was the Public Works Administration that, among many other projects, built the first civilian public housing in this country. It frequently built civilian public housing only for whites, primarily for whites, because there was an enormous housing shortage as a result of the Depression. And public housing was initially designed by the Public Works Administration to be for middle-class whites who were without homes during the Depression. The federal government built some housing for African-Americans as well, but housing was always segregated that the Public Works Administration built. And frequently, it created segregation in communities that had never known segregation before.
That's going to rock a lot of people's world, Richard, because, of course, the New Deal, it's Franklin Roosevelt. He's liberal in many respects. What I'm hearing is that he wasn't perhaps as liberal as we might like in terms of race.
Well, in terms of race, that's correct. Although, I will say that the New Deal built some housing for African Americans, who was always segregated. Mm-hmm. But African Americans began to vote Democratic during the New Deal in large numbers because they got some housing, some benefits from the New Deal, whereas previously they got none. So it's a mixed bag. The New Deal was a segregationist administration, but on the other hand, it provided benefits to African Americans that they never had before.
But the narrative that I've always heard is that Roosevelt, maybe in his heart of hearts, would have liked to help African Americans, and his wife, Eleanor, was encouraging him to help African Americans, and yet he didn't feel that politically he was able to do so. Is there any truth to that narrative?
Well, there's some truth. There's some partial truth to that. The partial truth is that in many areas, aside from housing, Roosevelt had to compromise with Southern Democrats in order to get economic legislation passed. So he could not get Social Security passed unless he excluded occupations that African Americans typically occupied. He could not get the minimum wage laws passed unless he excluded occupations that African Americans typically occupied. But this did not apply to housing, because Southern Democrats didn't care if housing in the North were integrated, just as they didn't care if schools in the North were integrated. They were concerned with maintaining the power to segregate their own communities. And there was no political compromise with Southern Democrats that was necessary in order to avoid segregating housing. There was political pressure from whites to segregate housing in the North. And so that you can say that Roosevelt acted under political pressure. But, you know, the reason we have a constitution is to protect minorities in particular and individuals from government action that may be popular. So whether you believe or not that Roosevelt in his heart of hearts would have done something different, the fact is it was a constitutional violation. It's no less a constitutional violation because it was popular among white voters, and it requires a remedy. What I started to say before is to give you this example, just to illustrate how dramatic this policy was that began with the Public Works Administration. In the book, I talk about the great American novelist, African-American novelist, the playwright, Langston Hughes, mm-hmm. who describes in his autobiography how he grew up in a integrated Cleveland neighborhood. There were many neighborhoods in many metropolitan areas at that time that were integrated because workers didn't have automobiles. They had to be close enough to their workplaces to walk to work. And so you had neighborhoods in all across the country where African Americans lived, where they lived among Polish immigrants and Irish immigrants and Italian immigrants and Jewish immigrants. And they all lived in the same neighborhoods, not necessarily next door, but in the same neighborhoods. Langston Hughes grew up in an integrated neighborhood in Cleveland. His best friend was Polish. He talks about dating a Jewish girl. Yet when the Public Works Administration came into that neighborhood in the 1930s, it demolished the housing in the neighborhood where Langston Hughes lived and built separate segregated public housing projects for whites and for blacks, creating segregation in a community that had never known it before. And this went on across the country, went on in the New Deal before World War II, and then it ramped up radically during World War II because hundreds of thousands of workers flocked to centers of defense production for work in the defense industry during World War II.
Right. There was a big riot in my hometown in Detroit, wasn't there, when they were building housing primarily for the Willow Run workers?
Well, I don't think the Willow Run plant, the housing for those workers, led to a riot. In fact, the Willow Run plant was built in a rural area where mm-hmm. there was no housing. Mm-hmm. And what the federal government did in that community was build housing for whites only. So if African Americans in Detroit wanted to work in the Willow Run plant, they had to figure out a way to get quite a distance to get there. At the time, it was in a rural suburban area. The government built housing for white workers only, explicitly for white workers only. It's not that white workers happened to apply for the housing and black workers didn't. But you had communities, I talk a lot in the book about California. And the reason I talk about California is because people think it's the most liberal area in the country, and they can understand that if this kind of segregation took place in California, it must have been going on everywhere. There was a large shipbuilding industry in Northern California. Richmond, California was the site of the Kaiser Shipyards. There were no African Americans to speak of living in Richmond, California before World War II. By the end of World War II, the population of Richmond had grown from less than 20,000 to 100,000. The African American population grew from a handful to 15,000. And during that period, there were these workers who flocked to Richmond to work in the shipyards and in other plants had no place to live. So what the federal government did was it built public housing for defense workers, built housing for African Americans along the railroad tracks near the shipyards in the industrial area. It built separate housing for whites in the more residential area. The white housing was much more substantial, creating segregation in a community that had never known it before.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author Richard Rothstein about his new book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Richard Rothstein. Stick around. And now it's time for our constitutional quiz, yet another one recorded at Vilnius University in Lithuania. So who are you, sir?
I'm Vojta Majer. It's my name.
Vojta?
Yeah.
Vojta, and where are you from?
Czech Republic.
Czech Republic, not Czechoslovakia.
No, not anymore.
Czech Republic, very important.
But I was born in Czechoslovakia.
I see. Well, we'll explore that in just a moment.
Okay.
And what are you doing here in Lithuania?
I'm studying here. I'm here through the Erasmus program.
Erasmus program. So you're one of these young scholars from all over Europe who come together and learn all important things from each other.
Yeah, that's
what a concept. And what are you studying in this class?
Here, you're studying American law.
American law. So are you going to be a lawyer?
Oh, no.
No, you're not going to be a lawyer.
No.
What are your plans?
I have no idea. You,
so like a lot of other students, you're just to enjoy your university studies.
Yeah.
And being around a bunch of attractive young women.
Of course.
Of course. Very good. All right, Vojta. You said you were born in Czechoslovakia, but you now live in the Czech Republic. So did you move?
No, I didn't move. Czechoslovakia for a part in 1903, and I was born
1993.
And I was born in 92.
So in 1992,
I think for 10 months I lived there.
Well, explain that a little bit. Now, where did Czechoslovakia originally come from, and what happened to make it fall apart?
Czechoslovakia originally it came after the First World War.
Right.
From it was a part of Austrian Hungarian Empire.
Right.
And after that, this empire lost the war, basically. It fell apart and our republic came to be.
Right. In fact, that was often traced back, or at least the political climate that allowed it to be created was part of Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, the idea that small countries should have the opportunity to express their own constitutional destiny, and that people should be able to freely choose their own governments. And so a number of smaller countries were created out of the debris of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the end of World War One, and Czechoslovakia is one of them. But that is basically two nations, though, Czech and Slovak.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that that was part of the reason eventually there was a split.
Yeah. In 93, they didn't like each other much. There was always some conflict in the government, so eventually they split apart.
Up to 1991 or so, it wouldn't have been possible for them to split because they were still under the influence of the Soviet Union, right?
Until 1989.
1989,
the, the regime fall. Yeah.
Right. Well, I guess the Soviet Union actually split up in 91, but the wall fell in Berlin in 1989. And so that's when Czechoslovakia started to determine its own destiny. Yeah. Very interesting. Okay, so you now live in the Czech Republic.
Yes.
And you're here learning about American legal system.
Yes.
And so are you ready to take a quiz? This is your final exam.
Oh.
Tell me, what role does the United States president play in the making of legislation?
In making legislation, he's signing off the new bill. He's agree if it is good or not by his from his point of view.
I see. So he doesn't actually write the law?
Not really. He only can do an executive order.
Right. So he will either sign the law or not sign the law. What happens if he doesn't sign the law?
If he doesn't sign the law, then it's go back to government. Or
back to the Congress?
Yeah. And they either dismiss the whole thing or rewrite it.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can also overvote it.
Override the veto.
But I think that doesn't happen very often in America.
That's true. It doesn't happen very often. Well, Vojta, you've just explained the legislative process in a way that many Americans would have difficulty doing. So very well done. You've learned a great deal. So congratulations to Vojta. Now, how does that compare with the power of the Czech president? Is that a similar role that the Czech president plays?
Yes, he has the similar powers, but he can do that executive order that he doesn't have this power.
I see. Very good. And who's your current president in the Czech Republic?
Now we have Miloš Zeman. It's his name, but he...
Miloš Zeman.
Miloš.
Miloš. Good. Zeman. Okay, sorry. Got to get it right. Miloš Zeman.
Yeah.
He was just
elected recently?
No. He was elected in 2013.
2013. And how long is his term?
For 5 years. So he ends next year.
Next year. So you'll have another election next year. All right. Well, good luck with next year's election. You've won a T-shirt, so make sure that Professor Harris has your address. Did you say you were, where do you live in the Czech Republic?
In Pilsen.
Pilsen?
Yeah.
Oh, I know all about Pilsen. What did you invent in Pilsen that the rest of the world still owes you thanks for?
Be like beer there.
You invented beer, didn't you?
Not really.
Come on, take credit. Take credit.
Okay, very good.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks very much. We appreciate your time, Wojta. Okay.
And now it's time to return to our discussion with Richard Rothstein. He is a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute and a fellow at the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. We're talking about his new book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America.
Well, it was overt and it was official.
It was overt. This was a common knowledge. This was not something they were sneaking into the regulations or something.
Oh, absolutely. The projects were designated for by race.
Yeah.
And this was true across the country.
Mm-hmm.
You're asking again what the reason was. The reason was that the New Deal, the Democratic Party at that time, was not liberal on racial matters. It was liberal on economic matters, and African Americans did get some benefits from that economic liberalism. But the administration was not liberal on racial matters. You mentioned before that Eleanor Roosevelt pressed her husband to do more for African Americans, but that was as time passed. As First Lady, she learned more and more about segregation in this country, and over the period of the Roosevelt administration became more and more aggressive towards her husband and trying to persuade him to be more egalitarian in his treatment of the races, but it didn't start out that way.
So even Eleanor Roosevelt had to gain some perspective on this issue before she became an advocate.
Yes.
Yeah, that's also a bit of a surprise because, of course, most people are familiar with the later Eleanor Roosevelt, who was very much a champion of civil rights, but very interesting. So it happened through the war, and I guess to some extent was justified by war exigencies to the extent it needed to be. What happened after the war?
Well, but let me say that there was no war exigency that required housing to be segregated. This was an assumption of the federal government that this was the way to do things. After the war, you still had a big civilian housing shortage because during the war, civilian construction was prohibited. Materials were only permitted to be used for purposes of war production. So there was an enormous civilian housing shortage. Veterans were returning, needing housing, and there was no place for them to live. They were living in Quonset huts and doubled up with relatives. And so President Truman in 1949 proposed a new housing act to build much more public housing to try to solve this shortage. Again, remember, this was primarily for working class families, lower middle class families. This was not for poor people. In fact, in the early days, let me go back a minute, in the early days when public housing was built, public housing agencies insisted on doing inspections of applicants' homes to make sure that they were sufficiently middle class, that they had good furniture, that their children were well behaved, that they showed marriage certificates. This was something that the public housing agencies did to ensure that the projects would be middle class. Well, President Truman proposed a National Housing Act to vastly expand the amount of public housing in the country. And conservatives in Congress, not Southerners, but conservatives in Congress, who were opposed to public housing not for racial reasons, because remember, it was not primarily for African Americans at that time. They were opposed to it because they did not believe in any public involvement in the private housing market. They decided that they would try to defeat the public housing bill that Truman proposed by proposing what we now call a poison pill amendment. That's an amendment that, if it's adopted, makes an entire bill unpalatable. So the conservatives in Congress, led by Senator Robert Taft of Ohio, the leading Republican in the Senate, proposed an amendment to the National Housing Act requiring that housing from now on had to be integrated. No more discrimination in public housing.
Oh, that's remarkable. You're right. That is the old poison pill strategy, isn't it?
Exactly. They thought that if they could get a coalition of Republicans opposed to public housing who would vote for this bill, and Northern liberals who would vote for the amendment, and Northern liberals who would vote for the amendment for reasons of racial equality, that they could get the amendment passed. And then once the amendment was attached to the bill, Southern Democrats who favored public housing would have abandoned the bill, and the bill would go down to defeat because Republicans would abandon it as well, leaving only Northern liberals in support. So Northern liberals, led by later became Vice President Hubert Humphrey, he was right in his first term as Senate at that time, Northern liberals fought against the integration amendment. And the integration amendment was defeated, permitting the housing bill as a whole to be passed. And as a result of that 1949 Housing Act, we saw the giant high-rises that came to characterize public housing. Prior to that, there had not been high-rises built all across the country. The Robert Taylor Homes in Chicago, Cabrini Green, the Pruitt-Igoe Towers in St. Louis. The high-rise towers that became familiar with were built under the provisions of this Housing Act with an explicit rejection of integration as a public policy.
Again, as you said, the integration amendment is defeated by liberals, which emphasizes the importance of not just looking at voting records, but understanding voting records. Yeah, and so Humphrey was very much in favor. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I always understood him to be in favor of racial equality as well as economic liberalism. So that probably was kind of hard for him to do.
Oh, it was very hard for him to do, and it may not have been the right thing to do. The choice was between no public housing at all or segregated public housing. That was the choice that the liberals faced. Mm-hmm. And they decided that segregated public housing was better than no public housing. That might not have been the right choice. It's true that families were in desperate need of housing. African Americans in particular were living in slum conditions. They needed good housing. So it was a very difficult choice to make. But the legacy of it that we see today is segregation across the country.
Hmm.
Now, well-known of these developments is the Pruitt-Igoe Towers in St. Louis. And eventually, they were blown up. They were dynamited in the 1970s because they became so dysfunctional. They were all African-American. They were low income. They were large numbers of unemployed families, single parents, and a lot of crime in the development, and drug dealing. And so eventually, the families were evicted from the Pruitt-Igoe Towers, and they were dynamited. But when the Pruitt-Igoe Towers were built in the early 1950s as a result of the funds from the 49 Housing Act, it was two separate projects. The Pruitt Towers were for African Americans. The Igoe Towers were for whites. It was an explicitly segregated project, like they all were. Again, this was not because whites happened to apply for the Igoe projects and blacks happened to apply for the Pruitt projects. These were designated by race. But after a few years, the civilian housing shortage ebbed. This is in the 1950s. And all of a sudden, you had large numbers of vacancies in the Igoe Towers, where the whites had been assigned, and long waiting lists in the Pruitt Towers, where the African Americans have been assigned. And this became characteristic of public housing all across the country. Everywhere you went, there were large vacancies in white projects and long waiting lists in black projects. Eventually, the government became, it was such an embarrassing situation that the Igoe Towers and similar projects around the country were opened up to African Americans, and the entire projects became black. At that point, the maintenance started to deteriorate. The government took less care of the projects, and they became vertical slums. But the reason that you had these large vacancies develop in the white projects is also critical to understanding this history.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, beginning in the New Deal, early in the New Deal, the Federal Housing Administration was established. Many people are familiar with the fact that the FHA wouldn't insure mortgages in African-American neighborhoods, red-line neighborhoods. What most people are not so familiar with is that the FHA had a much more important role in the history of this country, and that is they subsidized the suburbanization of the country by granting guarantees to bank loans for developers in entire suburbs to build single-family homes in the suburbs on explicit condition that they be for white families only.
That's a government essentially imposing restrictive covenants.
Which... Yes, it did. Explicitly restrictive covenants, as well as restrictions on the initial sale of homes to African Americans. So the best known example of this is perhaps the Levittown east of New York City. This is a development of 17,000 homes in the post-war period, the late 1940s. Levitt could never have afforded to construct 17,000 homes for whom he had no buyers. He would never have had the capital to do that. The only way he got the capital was by going to the federal government, the Federal Housing Administration, getting a guarantee of his bank loans to build the development. In order to get that guarantee, he had to provide all of the specifications of the development to the FHA, including a racial restriction. So, The bank loans were granted on condition that no homes be sold to African Americans, and, as you just said, with an additional condition that each deed have a clause in it that prohibits the owners from reselling to an African American. And this went on all across the country. This is how the country was suburbanized in the 1950s.
I have to stop you there because a very important case that we teach every year in our constitutional law classes is Shelley versus Kramer, which was 1948, where the Supreme Court said restrictive covenants that were privately entered into were unconstitutional.
Well, the Supreme Court didn't actually say that. I'm not a lawyer, so you'll forgive me. But uh-huh. The Supreme Court said was that state courts could not evict African Americans who bought homes in violation of the restrictive covenant. It did not say that the covenants themselves were unconstitutional. It said the state enforcement of the covenants were unconstitutional. And what happened after 1948 is the covenants were revised so that they didn't provide for eviction of the African American who might have bought a home in violation of the covenant. Instead, it provided for fines assessed on the homeowners who sold the homes to African Americans. And, for example, one of the developments that I write about in my book is south of San Francisco in Daly City, California, where the homes then were selling for about $10,000 a piece. That's close to $100,000 in today's dollars. And those restrictive covenants after Shelley versus Kramer had a provision that if any homeowner sold a home to an African American, the eight families closest to that home could collect a fine of $2,000 apiece, which was more than the value of the home. So that went on for another 5 years, and it wasn't until 1953 that the Supreme Court found that to be unconstitutional, that kind of use of state courts to enforce those kinds of fines, those assessments, to be unconstitutional. Restrictive covenants continued to be placed on homes as private agreements after that, and the FHA continued to subsidize developments like Levittown or like Daly City and hundreds of developments in between the two coasts, knowing full well that the builder would not sell homes to African Americans. The federal government, even after Shelley v. Kramer and after the subsequent court decision, never required builders who got federal guarantees for developments to sell their homes on a non-discriminatory basis.
Generally speaking, before a constitutional right can be asserted, there has to be action by the government. And that was the issue in Shelley versus Kramer. You know, these were restrictive covenants that had been entered into between private parties. So where was the government? Well, Shelley, as you say, said that courts could not enforce these restrictive covenants because it was the courts who were the governmental actors. It was the fact that a judge was entering an order saying black family move out. That was the government's involvement. Of course, the problem with that concept is that means that every court case is a constitutional case. Even garden variety torts cases or slip and fall cases or property disputes could be constitutionalized under that theory. And so Shelley is not often followed, and that in terms of the government action doctrine or the state action doctrine, as it's often called. It's been rarely invoked since that time. And that's generally what we talk about Shelley as being significant regarding the doctrine of state action. But what most people will casually say about Shelley, which I said a few minutes ago, is that effectively it declared unconstitutional these restrictive covenants. You've just taught me something. They found a way around that. They found workarounds around Shelley.
They found workarounds around it. And in fact, county recorders of deeds continued to record restrictive covenants, new restrictive covenants, all the way into the 1970s.
Even knowing that they were not judicially enforceable.
That's correct.
See, now that reminds me of all kinds of massive resistance to civil rights regulations. And indeed, it reminds me very strongly of the recent dispute over gay rights and gay marriage, where local clerks were refusing to implement the Supreme Court's decision. So there was all of this quiet resistance all throughout these governmental offices up into the 1970s. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Richard Rothstein of the Economic Policy Institute, who's written a new book called The Color of Law, Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Richard Rothstein. Stick around. Now it's time to finish our discussion with Richard Rothstein of the Economic Policy Institute and his new book, The Color of Law, Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. There is an uneven history here that mirrors the uneven history of the civil rights movement generally. We tend to think that decisions, landmark decisions like Brown versus Board of Education, solve everything. Well, no. There's lots of resistance, and Richard Rothstein is telling us about some of it.
Well, I think that you'll find that the resistance to government Supreme Court race decisions like Shelley went on a lot longer than you'll see the resistance of clerks not performing marriages go on.
And as you say, the government itself continued to violate at least the spirit of Shelley, if not the specific holding of Shelley versus Kramer.
Actually, Shelley brings up an interesting side issue, because I mentioned the two most powerful government policies, public housing that was explicitly segregated, and Federal Housing Administration policy designed to create all-white suburbs. But there were many, many others, and Shelley actually raises an interesting one. You probably also teach in your courses, in your constitutional law courses, a case that came up in the 1980s where the IRS withheld the tax exemption of Bob Jones University.
Ah, yeah.
Because it prohibited interracial dating. Interestingly, as you probably know, the Reagan administration refused to defend the IRS in this case, and so the court appointed its own substitute advocate for the IRS. And in that decision, the Supreme Court said that the IRS was acting appropriately in denying a tax exemption to Bob Jones University. Well, interracial dating is an important thing to protect, but it's trivial compared to the extent to which the IRS throughout the 20th century gave tax exemptions to institutions that were engaged in explicit policy to segregate neighborhoods. So the reason I connect this to Shelley is because what you may not know is that the plaintiff in the Shelley case that was trying to evict the African-American family was the local Presbyterian church.
Oh, which gets a tax exemption.
And nobody ever challenges tax exemption. And this went on across the country. Many, many neighborhood associations that were organized for the purpose of circulating the covenants that we've been talking about in order to keep neighborhoods all white were based in local churches or synagogues. The example that I discuss at greater length in The Color of Law is the University of Chicago, where Robert Hutchins, who was the president of the University of Chicago for many years and is known as a great liberal educator, in the office of the presidency of the University of Chicago, was a legal office whose role it was to prosecute violations of restrictive covenants in the neighborhood of the University of Chicago. And this was not secret. This was the role of this legal office in the office of the president. They spent over $100,000 enforcing restrictive covenants in the neighborhoods around the University of Chicago. And the IRS never challenged the tax exemption of the University of Chicago during this period. And I don't mean to pick on the University of Chicago. As I say, there were thousands of churches, private nonprofit organizations, libraries, private libraries, that organized restrictive covenants quite openly and or otherwise enforced segregation in their neighborhoods. And it never raised the attention of the Internal Revenue Service. And this is another example of de jure segregation. It's not a law, but it was a policy of the IRS to subsidize segregation in metropolitan areas.
And I imagine that many of these nonprofits, many of these churches, use the same rationale that the developers did, which is, oh, I'm not a racist and I'm not bigoted, but you know, I have to account for the fact that a lot of people are. And if I'm a developer, I have to segregate. Otherwise, I won't be able to sell my houses.
Well, that's true.
I mean, that was the standard response, wasn't it?
The churches had another response, as they many of the churches were ethnically based. And they didn't want their neighborhoods to change because they would lose their parishioners.
I hadn't specifically thought of that, but a lot of urban churches did fall by the wayside because their parishioners moved out and then the churches weren't able to stay open.
But this is not a constitutional defense.
Oh, no. I'm simply saying I'm trying to understand what the motivations were of organizations that are ostensibly there for good purposes. And yet they're acting in ways that are very, very discriminatory. Okay, so this takes us up to roughly the 1960s. Did things start to change then?
Well, we passed the Fair Housing Act in 1968. But the Fair Housing Act only prohibits future discrimination. It did nothing to remedy the effects of the segregation that the government had created. And let me illustrate to you why the Fair Housing Act was insufficient for that reason. I mentioned to you before Levittown or Daly City or the many, many other suburbs like that that were created in the mid-20th century by the FHA as racially exclusive suburbs. Well, Levittown and Daly City, both of them, the homes then sold at mid-20th century for about $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 apiece. As I said before, that's about $100,000 in today's terms. The white families who bought those homes, they and their children and their grandchildren, over the course of the next 30, 40, 50 years, gained enormous equity in those homes. Homes in Levittown today sell for $300,000, $400,000. So white families who owned those homes gained let's assume that they spent some money in remodeling, so it's not all a gain in equity, but let's say they gained $200,000, $300,000 in wealth as a result of this federal subsidy that enabled them to buy those homes. African-American families who were equally capable of buying those homes, equally able to afford a home for $100,000 in today's terms, in those days, that's only twice national median income. Working-class families can afford to buy a home at twice national median income. But African-American families were denied the opportunity to do that. They were forced to live in apartments, mostly in urban areas. They gained none of that wealth. The result is that today, African-American incomes are about 60% of white incomes. But African-American wealth is only 5% of white wealth. And that enormous disparity between 60% income ratio and 5% wealth ratio is almost entirely attributable to federal racial housing policy in the mid-20th century. So to pass the Fair Housing Act in 1968, which prohibits future discrimination, is an important thing to do. But it's in effect saying to African Americans, okay, you can now move to Levittown. We're no longer going to prohibit you from doing so. But it's now unaffordable for working class families. Those homes, as I say, now sell for $300,000, $400,000. That's seven or eight times national median income, no longer affordable to working and lower middle class families. And so we've never remedied the policy that the federal government pursued in the mid-20th century, and the Fair Housing Act doesn't remedy it.
I've often heard it said, I'm not an economist, but I've often heard it said that for most people, the equity they get in their home is the single biggest investment they have.
Yeah, it's the single biggest source of wealth for middle-class families in this country.
Right. And so what you're saying is that African-Americans were denied the ability to create that nest egg.
Well, they were denied the ability to create that nest egg. White families were able to use the equity in their homes for a variety of things. They bequeathed it to their children, or they spent it to help them in their retirement, or they spent it for medical emergencies, or to send their children to college. African-American families were able to do none of those things. And so the ongoing effects of this residential segregation persist even into the present time.
I've often heard it said about the Fair Housing Act of 1968 that while it does have enforcement mechanisms, and there has been some enforcement, that it has not been consistently or fully enforced ever. Is that also true?
Well, that's true, but I think that's mistaking a smaller issue for a bigger one. It's true that the Fair Housing Act has not been enforced. But even with perfect enforcement, I'm sorry, I don't mean it's not been enforced. It's not been enforced as well as it might have been. But even with perfect enforcement, it would not touch the major issue, which is the one that I've been talking about, which is the vast majority of African-American families who can no longer afford to move into the suburbs from which they were excluded, not because they've gotten poorer, but because the homes have become so much more expensive. And even if the Fair Housing Act was perfectly enforced, we would not have very many African-American families in these middle-class suburbs that were created by the Fair Housing Act. And there's another aspect of this as well, if I can add.
Sure.
It was not just in housing. The inability of African-American families to afford to live in middle-class neighborhoods was a result of other federal policies as well. In the mid-1930s, another New Deal policy, and this is another example of the kind of thing we were talking about before, was the National Labor Relations Act. It was sponsored by Senator Robert Wagner of New York. When Senator Wagner proposed the National Labor Relations Act, he proposed that unions that were certified by the federal government to have exclusive bargaining rights with their employers would have to be non-discriminatory. That provision in the National Labor Relations Act was removed before the bill was passed.
And so black people didn't get union jobs.
They didn't get union jobs. And not only were African Americans prohibited from living in the suburbs, but they were prohibited from participating in its construction and from gaining the benefits of the enormous income boom that the working class experienced in the years after World War II.
Well, as you pointed out at the beginning of our discussion, and we are getting near the end of it now, this mythology, as you call it, of the de facto discrimination has had significant constitutional implications up to the present day. If the court continues to typify so much of the segregation as being non-governmental, then there really isn't a constitutional remedy. So I'm guessing you'd like the court to recognize that. I guess you'd like every member of the court to read your book and recognize that they're basing their holdings on a false premise.
Well, you know, to be truthful with you, I don't care if the members of the court read my book. It's the public that needs to learn this history.
Mm-hmm.
Because the court is not going to get ahead of the public on this issue. We need a new consensus among policymakers, among informed people in this country about the extent to which the segregated residential patterns in every metropolitan area are a violation of the Constitution and about the need to remedy it. And this can't be remedied through litigation. So the court will come into play only later when Congress or state legislatures adopt policies that might be explicitly racial in order to remedy this unconstitutional segregation. And the court will be called upon to rule on the constitutionality of these policies. And the court's decision about whether these policies are constitutional will have to be based on a recognition of this history. But we won't get anywhere near that point until the public and their representatives, or their elected representatives, become familiar with the history and about the need to remedy residential segregation.
Well, briefly, what are some of the policies that you think an enlightened legislature might enact that might help with this situation?
Well, there are many, from fairly small ones to larger ones. Right now, for example, the federal government has three major housing programs. The largest and the most expensive housing program that the federal government runs is the mortgage interest deduction that is granted to the same families that benefited from the initial subsidies in these single-family home suburbs. If we were aware of the kind of segregation that created the suburbs, one thing we might do is withhold or place in escrow the mortgage interest deductions of homes in suburbs that maintain segregation, that, for example, adopted zoning laws or maintained zoning laws that prohibit the construction of single-family homes on smaller lot sizes that middle-class or working-class families can afford, or that prohibit the construction of townhouses or apartments. That would be one policy that would be justified based on the knowledge of this history.
Those zoning regulations are ubiquitous, too. They exist all over the country. And there have been some attempts, the Mount Laurel decision, et cetera, to try to remedy that circumstance. But you think that withholding the mortgage interest deduction would be, well, that would be a pretty effective way, wouldn't it, to induce people to change their ways?
I think so. I think it would be effective, and it would not be a big burden. I'm not suggesting that the mortgage deduction could be placed in escrow until a subdivision adopted policies to integrate and abandon its exclusionary policies. So that would be one policy. But I said that's the major housing policy the federal government runs. The federal government also has two other housing programs that are aimed at the poor families. One is well known. It's called the Section 8 program, or the Housing Choice Voucher program. And that program operates today to reinforce segregation. The way it operates is that the families are given a subsidy to top up their rental payments so that they spend no more than one-third of their income on rent. But the subsidy is calculated based on what the median rent in the metropolitan area is. The result is that the subsidy is too little to afford to rent an apartment in a middle-class neighborhood where the rentals are higher, and it's actually too much to rent an apartment in an already segregated neighborhood, and landlords exploit the program by charging more than the market requires.
Oh, my.
The families that have a Section 8 voucher. So the government could very easily prohibit the use of Section 8 vouchers in already segregated neighborhoods, or at least create incentives to use them in middle-class neighborhoods, and vary the amount of the subsidy based on the kind of neighborhood that the family chooses to use it in. And in fact, at the very end of the Obama administration, they adopted a new rule along those lines, providing higher subsidies for renting of homes, of apartments in middle-class communities, and lower subsidies for the rental of homes in segregated communities. But the Trump administration has suspended the enforcement of that rule. So we're still in the situation that we were in. The other problem is that in most places in the country, landlords are permitted to discriminate against Section 8 voucher holders. So they refuse to rent to somebody on the basis of the fact that part of their rent is coming from a federal voucher. And this, of course, also reinforces segregation, because that leaves the only places where families can use the vouchers in already segregated neighborhoods. And then the third.
Well, Richard, before we get to, I'm sorry, we don't have time for the third one. People will simply have to read your book. But once again, what's the title of the book?
The Color of Law: Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America.
Well, this is fascinating. I'm guessing it's available on Amazon and at your local bookstore, and it's certainly something that people should go out and read and understand. And we thank you very much for coming on and telling us all about it.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Richard Rothstein of the Economic Policy Institute, and also of the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. What a fascinating and enlightening conversation. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.